Now, the Buckeye Extra Podcast with Rob Aller, Bill Rabinowitz, and Joey Kaufman from the Columbus Dispatch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Buckeye Extra Football Podcast. This is Joey Kaufman. I'm joined by Bill Rabinowitz. Rob Aller is out for this recording of the postgame podcast, so you'll just hear Bill and I break down Ohio State's 45-12 win over Arkansas State on Saturday. At times, it was maybe a little closer than the final score ultimately indicated. It was a 17-9 game in the second quarter, but the Buckeyes ultimately, I think, flexed their muscles and sort of ran away with it in the second half. But unlike a lot of other teams across the country, you can't take beating teams from the Sun Belt for granted, apparently.
Yeah, that's, I wrote my analysis today. That's, I don't know if it's been posted or not, or it will just be in tomorrow's paper. But yeah, sometimes a few hours of time will make you appreciate something a little bit more. Because, yeah, Marshall beats Notre Dame, and Georgia Southern beats Nebraska, which ended Scott Frost's career, and Appalachian
State. His tenure,
that's right. Maybe his career, we'll see. We'll see if it destroyed his career. And Appalachian State beat Texas A&M, so proving that their 2007 victory over Michigan was no fluke for that program. So what a crazy day. Alabama survives Texas. Texas was a 3-touchdown underdog. There are other ones that were surprises. Wisconsin loses at Washington State, or maybe at home. I don't know where that game was played, but they lost to Washington State. Crazy. So you look at Ohio State's win and you go, okay, well, first of all, maybe the Sun Belt Conference isn't so bad. And then you go, okay, their passing game got going and they held Arkansas State without a touchdown. As Ryan Day said, anytime you hold a team without a touchdown, it's a good day for the Buckeyes. So, yeah, it wasn't flawless. It was ugly at times, 4-3 and outs by the offense, not good. But it was a comfortable win. And sometimes you just take the W and say, thank you, and move on.
I think it's a good summation of things. I think people probably certainly appreciate, I think your analysis was pretty correct. I think it was a good angle to take, because you have to appreciate wins somewhat, because largely Ohio State has avoided, in the Ryan Day era, a total clunker where you lose to a team you shouldn't lose to. And maybe their issue is beating some of the teams that sort of are on par with them, like last year, Oregon and Michigan. But you haven't seen just sort of an inexplicable loss like Texas A&M, a top 10 team losing to Appalachian State, or Nebraska losing to Georgia Southern, and even last week being in a competitive ball game against North Dakota. So I think that certainly colors maybe the way we view things. I guess I didn't think it was maybe as bad as some people thought Ohio State's win. I thought largely it was a good sign for them to get their passing game on track. I think the bigger issue to me maybe is some of the penalty stuff and some of the concerns that have popped up in the secondary. Denzel Burke, it felt like was giving up maybe too many big plays, had a couple pass interferences. He was somebody who was supposed to be the lockdown, shutdown corner guy. But to me, I think my biggest takeaway from the game on Saturday was just the passing game, which was fine in week one, just looked so much more explosive. C.J. Stroud averaged 14.6 yards per pass attempt, hit Marvin Harrison Jr. for 3 touchdowns. They had, I think it was 7 plays of 30 yards or more per pass attempt. I mean, that's a lot of explosiveness, something that we didn't see in week one. I don't think there was really any doubt that Ohio State passing game would reemerge. But I think still, if you're an Ohio State fan, you want to see them with a pulse, and they had a pulse without having Jackson Smith and Jigba and Julian Fleming, and frankly, they had more than a pulse. They put up a lot of yards.
Some of that, though, is the way the defenses have played the first 2 weeks. Notre Dame made it pretty clear they were not going to let Ohio State get behind them. They were going to make them kind of dink and dunk down the field, and that's what they did. And Appalachian State had more of the strategy: we're going to try to contain the run game, make them one-dimensional, take away kind of the outside and, you know, see if they could just kind of beat us over the top and over the middle. And Ohio State did. And that's the thing about Ohio State. They can beat you in so many ways. If you decide to just play the pass, and Trevion Henderson and Mayan Williams will be able to run behind that offensive line for chunks of yardage. C.J. Stroud, such an accurate passer that you just can't give them windows. And even without Jackson Smith and Jacob, I mean, you look at Marvin Harrison Jr. and Emeka Egbuka, and those guys, it was like, what, 86% of the percentage of the completions yesterday? Yeah. That was your stat, right?
Right. I think it was about 86% of the total passing yards went to those two guys. Stroud, CJ threw 351 yards. 184 went to Marvin Harrison Jr. 118 went to Emeka Egbuka. The next leading receiver was Xavier Johnson, three catches for 14 yards. Then Cade Silver, two catches for 40 yards. So a bulk of the catches and yards went to those top two guys.
Yeah, I thought the protection was better yesterday, as you would expect. Look, Arkansas State's defensive line is nothing like Notre Dame's defensive line. But the protection was really good. And if you give C.J. Stroud time, he's going to just light you up. It's just the way it's going to be. Defensively, here's the puzzling thing. Through two games, they have no turnovers, which is really surprising given the way that they've been aggressive and been around the ball. And I don't recall them even being close to one yesterday. Maybe I'm forgetting. I'll do a video review tonight or tomorrow and look for that. But they're very sound. You know, they did have some missed tackles, though. Cornerbacks, I mean, Cam Brown had a missed tackle. As you mentioned, Denzel Burke, I don't know what the issue is with him. I think you pointed out that he missed some time in training camp. Maybe he's just kind of rounding into form. He's too good a player to not make the plays that we're used to seeing. I mean, he's just too good.
That's what I would think. It feels like with Denzel Burke, maybe we're flying a little blind because we didn't really have a ton of great injury information on him
in
August. And if he missed significant time, well, I'm sure you're going to come into the season being a little rusty.
And at that position, cornerback play is such a split-second thing. You either make the play or you don't. The margin between success and failure is inches, and it's split seconds. And it's not like he's gotten beat like 5 yards away from the receiver. It's not that. He just hasn't made the play. Sometimes you make the play, sometimes you don't. And maybe it's just the law of averages that right now he's not, and later on he will. It's just kind of strange. But, you know, on the defensive line, Mike Hall, once again, looked dominant. JT Tuimoloau, I thought, looked really good again. We saw Tommy Eichenberg and Steel Chambers play well at linebacker. So I think we pretty much have a pretty good idea what the defense is at this point. Just when will they start to generate turnovers?
Yeah, you talked about Denzel Burke's timing. I think on one of the pass interference calls, I can't remember if it was the first or the second, but I remember the way the play unfolded. It was a jump ball, and essentially he landed on the receiver too early. He started his ascent into the air way early, and the timing was all off, and he ended up landing on the guy. So that felt like an instance where maybe he's being a little overeager or just some extra juice. But you're right. I think some of the timing and the rhythm stuff with him is off. Kind of maybe, I don't know if it's similar at all to Josh Proctor, who talked to us after the game, and he got the start. People obviously remember he got the start against Notre Dame on the first play of the game, goes into tackle Lorenzo Styles and misses. And that turns into a 45-yard completion for the Irish, and then gets substituted out for Lathan Ransom, who holds that spot. Well, Proctor ended up coming back and making the start this week. He said basically he tried to calm himself down, not think, just play football, kind of get out of his own head. But he felt a lot of excitement about getting to play in a football game again for the first time in a while. So he basically split reps with Ransom in the game. They were about equal. Ransom had 39 snaps, Proctor at 38. So that's where they are as far as the Pro Football Focus snap counts for those two guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to feel pretty good about where the defense is right now. They've given up one touchdown in two games. And you figure that turnovers are going to come. Turnovers tend to come in waves. And there'll probably be some game, maybe it's this week, who knows, where they have five turnovers. They just, it's just the way it goes. They're flying to the ball well enough. They're pressuring the quarterback well enough to get it. It just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I view the turnover thing, I guess, more curiosity than concern. It feels like they're going to come, as you say, because you look at the way Ohio State's been able to get pressure on quarterbacks. I think they've done pretty well in that category all in all this year, especially just tackles for loss. Mike Hall has five tackles for loss. And last year, and that's five tackles for loss through two games. Last year, nobody had more than seven. I mean, Zach Harrison and Askell Garrett had seven. So for a guy who's been in the backfield so much, you'd think one of them might just result in a fumble or something like that. And then they're looking at their sack numbers. They have five this year. I mean, there have been times where Steel Chambers and Tommy Eichenberg have been in the backfield making plays. It feels like the amount of havoc that they've caused would have resulted in a bad throw that just sort of lands in somebody's arms.
Yeah. Again, it's still early in the season. It's two games into a 12-game season, 12-game regular season. And yeah, I always hesitate to kind of make sweeping generalizations about things. What you're looking for are signs and indicators. And I don't think there have been major surprises from what we've seen. I mean, I don't know if there's any stat or anything that I've seen so far, other than the penalties. And we should address that a little bit, because these are not just.
I think Brian Day should address that.
Well, I'm sure he will. He said after the game he would. That was the one thing you could tell that he was pretty upset about after the game.
Yeah.
I mean, you had one, the biggest one. I don't know if it was the most egregious, because I don't really fault Roger Mitchell for trying to block a punt and kind of giving everything he had to block it. But he leaped over the two guys who were acted as the shield for the punter, and that's illegal. Honestly, that's more of a coaching thing to me, because I would assume that's not the first time Taraja has done that. He probably did it in practice. And if that's the case, then that should have been pointed out to him that that's an illegal play. Or maybe it just might have been the adrenaline of the game. And he thought, maybe if I really extend myself. I mean, that's not one I really take fault with. I mean, but some of these unsportsmanlike conduct penalties, that's just, as Day said, it's ridiculous. You know, somebody slaps you or says something to you, you know. I mean, you, these guys have played sports long enough. I mean, I used to tell my son in rec ball, don't retaliate, because that's the one the refs will see. They usually don't see the first one, the first, you know, the instigator. They see the guy who retaliates. And these guys have played for a long time. They know that. And you just have to keep your cool. I mean, Tron Vincey got one at the end of the – we were at halftime and we find out Ohio State got another penalty. You're like, they can't even escape penalties at halftime? And so that's the kind of thing. It's one of these days, if they can continue to do that, it's going to bite them in the butt, because they're going to be games when those yards matter. And that's something they need to nip in the bud. It's one thing to have – you know, so you're going to have penalties. It's a fast-moving game. It's a violent game. It's going to happen. But it's the type and the timing that I'm sure is driving Ryan Day nuts.
I mean, they don't have to go far in their memory bank for a time when penalties really hampered them. Last year's game in Michigan, there were a couple of times in the red zone where they were called for false starts that set back some drives, and they settled for field goals. I mean, that's a big part of the reason why they got behind in that game and things snowballed the way they did. No pun intended. So... That was only a couple games ago. I mean, I guess they didn't have the false start penalty. That was more of an issue that presented itself in game one against Notre Dame. But this one had a lot of those odd penalties you point out, the one at halftime with the unsportsmanlike conduct by Tron Vincent. And some of those other ones were just sort of strange. You don't really see those too often called.
Again, if you want to look on the positive side, that in theory should be easy to correct. Right.
I mean, yeah.
You emphasize it in practice. You see any sign of it and during a practice, you put your foot down. I don't think that's like going to be a chronic issue with this team, but it's got to be fixed. You thought after the Notre Dame game, when there were too many penalties, that would be a point of emphasis and they would cut down on them against Arkansas State, and they didn't. So, again, some of this is just kind of nitpicking, but first of all, that's kind of what we do. Sorry.
when you run an Ohio State football podcast, they only lose one or twice a year, and then the sky's falling. So the rest of the time, you're grading on a curve.
You're grading on it, right. The bar is very high. That's what it is. And in most ways, they're playing to that level. I think C.J. Stroud played much better against Arkansas State than he did against Notre Dame when he was off on some throws, especially early. It just took him a little while to get used to things. I thought he was really on target. He didn't try to make a perfect pass when a very good pass would do, like the touchdown pass to Egbuka over the middle. That was a beautiful throw, because he knew he had him and he didn't have to try to make it perfect. Just laid it up there and let him catch it and go. Marvin Harrison, kind of the same thing on the deep sideline pass. So sometimes you got to throw a dart and fit it into tight windows, and other times you just put the ball up and let the receiver do his job. And I think CJ Stroud is pretty good at that.
Yeah, I think to me that was, I think, as I mentioned at the top, encouraging to see the passing game reemerge. I think we expected that. I think one guy who I did not expect maybe to be this impactful early this year, and we touched on him, has been Mike Hall. I mean, I know he had a big training camp. People raved about him. But to come in and to be in the backfield as often as he's been, I mean, there have been times where you'll just bull rush somebody and bring somebody down in the backfield. I'm trying to remember if there's been somebody you think has been this impactful for Ohio State interior linemen, because I think when people think about the Ohio State defensive linemen, you think about the pass rushers, you think about Chase Young, and you think about the Bosa brothers. But at least in my time covering the beat, it feels like his first step is really elite.
Yeah. I mean, Draymond Jones had a little bit of that. Bigger guy. Smaller guy was B.B. Landers, Robert Landers. He was always a part-time player and honestly not that dominant. He was kind of a change of pace guy who was really effective because he was, you know, short by defensive line standards. He kind of get under people's pads and be really disruptive. But, I don't know that B.B. Landers had 5 tackles for loss in 2 games in any stretch. I mean, I'd have to look it up, but I'd be surprised. And so for Mike Hall to do what he's done, and they're not just kind of fluky plays. I mean, you watch them, and as you said, it's either a bull rush or just a quick first step, and he's past the guy. He makes the offensive lineman look silly sometimes. And when you factor in that they've got the defensive ends they do, with Tuimoloau and Zach Harrison and Jack Sawyer, although he's kind of, you know, that Jack's kind of moving around everywhere. That's a pretty, that's pretty good. And, you can see that this defensive line has a real chance to be elite.
Yeah. I was even looking up like Haskell Garrett's numbers when he had his breakout year.
Right.
20. I mean, he had 4 tackles for loss that whole year.
Wow. So that's a good example because he was, 2020, right? 2020, he was a dominant player. He really was. And when you have a dominant interior rusher, it just blows up everything. Sometimes on the perimeter, if that guy doesn't get him, it doesn't necessarily blow up the play. But when you get rushed from the interior, quarterback really has nowhere to go. He's flushed out of the pocket, and then somebody else can get him, that's when you're going to get the turnovers.
Yeah, the good news for Ohio State fans and for this team is it doesn't look like we saw him on the field for a little bit and received medical attention. You thought about, geez, that's, I think, one of the injuries Ohio State could least afford in terms of the long run of this season and achieving the goals that they want to, because, I mean, right now they're chasing Alabama, they're chasing Georgia. They want to have a chance to knock off those SEC teams this year in a playoff. I think you need somebody like Mike Hall to be able to do that in a playoff game, to be disruptive at the line of scrimmage against those teams, and even just to beat Michigan again this year and hold off on the Wolverines. But it looks like Ryan Day said he did not expect Mike Hall to miss any time. His shoulder was getting looked at. Trainers were looking at his left shoulder. They were stretching it out. I don't recall that he came back in the game, but it was the third quarter of a blowout, so I'm sure that weighs on them as well, and as far as that decision. But looks like he should be healthy moving forward.
Yeah, Ryan Day did not seem concerned about it after the game. Maybe we ought to talk a little bit about the Big Ten and the national picture. We touched on it at the top of this, but it's funny. One thing that Warm holds true, all Big Ten East teams are undefeated, although it helps when you like Rutgers is playing Wagner, I think. Yeah. And the only undefeated team in the West is Minnesota. So every team in the West has lost a game other than the Gophers. And, maybe this is not the year that the West is finally going to win the championship. But, I didn't see any of the Michigan game. They got a late start against Hawaii, and Hawaii is just brutally bad. They're just terrible. But the significance of that game is that afterward, Jim Harbaugh announced that J.J. McCarthy would be the starting quarterback, presumably for the rest of the year, or at least for the foreseeable future, beating out Cade McNamara, who was the incumbent last year, who obviously played against Ohio State and played well against Ohio State. McCarthy is viewed as being more of a, having much more potential, being able to make something out of nothing more than McNamara, who's probably a little bit unfairly described as a game manager. I think he's a little bit more than that, but he's certainly not the athlete that McCarthy is. I think it's interesting that Harbaugh is taking the approach that he has with them, and he's made a decision already.
Yeah, I watched bits and pieces of that game. I feel like I was channel flipping quite a bit because we were watching another Nebraska train wreck, and it's one of those.
Yes, you can't look away.
Yeah, I was going to say I will miss the Scott Frost era because it really just sort of every time you turn on a Nebraska game, it's like, ooh, how are they going to blow this one?
And they did
to Georgia Southern, but. That was the right decision by Jim Harbaugh. I mean, J.J. McCarthy is clearly the more talented quarterback, and it's Michigan's playing some really big bottom feeders to start the year, from Colorado State to Hawaii, so you have to take some stuff with a grain of salt. But, I mean, he has a great arm. McCarthy can run the ball. He's a lot more just as a broader skill set than Cade McNamara goes. And this schedule really allows you to ease his way into it. The curious part is it seems like if he's clearly a more talented passer, it would have been, an ideal situation to start him from game one and give him even more games under his belt, unless Jim Harbaugh was trying to prove a point publicly and put both guys on display and kind of get more of the fan base maybe behind one of the two guys. I don't know. He's sort of weird. But
well, yeah.
I don't know. McCarthy looks like the much better quarterback between those two guys to me. If you're Michigan and you want to go back to the playoff and you want to beat Ohio State again and you want to advance further in the playoff, I think you have to tap into a guy with a higher ceiling.
Yeah, I agree. I think he approached the way he digs. I think he wanted to give the appearance that it was an open competition. And let's say Cade McNamara goes in against Colorado State and lights it up, and McCarthy against Hawaii is just so-so. Then maybe he makes a different decision. But I think that this was probably the plan all along, was for to give McNamara enough of a chance to kind of, you know, not seize the job. I don't know. You know, Harbaugh, it's hard to read him because he's kind of so inscrutable in so many ways that trying to read his mind is pointless. But that's my best guess as to why he approached it the way he did. And I think he made the right call. McCarthy's only a sophomore. He's going to be around. And if you want to have a chance to get back to the playoff and win it, I mean, I don't think Michigan has the talent to do that, but I didn't think so at this time last year either. This is probably what you do.
Yeah, he was in the same recruiting class as Kyle McCord for Ohio State fans who might remember that recruitment at all. The Buckeyes picked Kyle McCord. He was their guy, not J.J. McCarthy. So that's where things landed. It should be an interesting game between the two of them next year. Figuring McCord, if he does win the job next year, it could be a little fun matchup, a little fun subplot to that game.
Right. You know, and I was surprised Wisconsin lost to Washington State. They only scored, I forget what the score was. It was like 14-10 or something like that. I'll look it up. But, I mean, that's surprising to me. What was the score here? I'll look it up right now, folks.
I think it was 17-14.
17-14. Yeah, they were up 14-7 at halftime and didn't score in the second half. Graham Mertz, 18 of 31, 227. Maybe that's what Graham Mertz is.
Yeah, it was a bad slate for the Big Ten because I remember going into this one thinking that you look at all the teams they were playing, it felt like there was no great Big Ten matchup. They were just all playing a lot of teams that they should beat, but Northwestern loses to Duke. You mentioned Wisconsin losing to Washington State. Iowa's
offense, by the way, is almost prehistoric. They are so bad on offense that look, they're very good defensively. They're very good, but it's hard to believe that the offense could be this inept, like week after week. It was, you know, this year that somehow they got to the Big Ten championship game last year with that offense. It's just crazy.
It feels like Kirk Ferentz may need to part with his son as the offensive coordinator.
Well,
starting to feel that way.
Yeah. You know, you look at the rest of the Big Ten. Indiana had to rally to beat Idaho. They were down at halftime. That's not a, you know, an impressive win. As you mentioned, Northwestern loses to Duke. And Minnesota's undefeated. Look, they beat the Western Illinois this week. The Leathernecks, if I'm not mistaken.
It's weird because you look at this whole schedule that Ohio State's going to play and you just think, who's going to beat them? I think in the preseason, you maybe thought Wisconsin and Iowa would look – I guess I didn't expect Iowa's offense to look this bad, and Wisconsin shouldn't be losing games to Washington State. So that October stretch now feels – I think that the midseason stretch looks a little more manageable. But outside of Michigan State on October 8th or Michigan end of the year, Penn State, that's about it.
Yeah, I think those are the three. Michigan State in part because it's the first road game for Ohio State. And in Penn State, it's, again, a road game. And Penn State always plays Ohio State tough. At least they don't play intimidated against them. There have been a few blowouts. But Penn State's the one Big Ten team that never kind of backs down to Ohio State. And then you have Michigan, which certainly to this point looks like it'll be a formidable team. Other than that, I mean, Indiana certainly doesn't. Rutgers doesn't. You know, Maryland, I guess you could say, being the week before Michigan and Tagovailoa is a good quarterback. There was the game in 18 where they almost beat Ohio State before Ohio State played Michigan. So I guess you can't overlook them entirely, but, you know, that's the only time that Maryland ever came close to beating Ohio State. So I wouldn't expect that, and that'll be the test of Ryan Day's competitive stamina and all that stuff, because if ever there's a game they'll look past, it's the Maryland game. But, yeah, I mean, you would have thought entering the season that Wisconsin would be a tough game and Iowa would be a tough game, and they still could be. But in terms of Iowa – I mean, you score a couple of touchdowns and the game's over, right? I mean, that's just – their offense is just that bad.
I guess to me, my takeaway from the first couple of weeks is the schedule is more top-heavy than I originally thought, partly because I think a lot of those teams like Wisconsin, Iowa have just looked so unimpressive. But I think even Michigan, even though they played a soft schedule, has looked pretty good. It feels like they might have the one offense that could really be able to hang with Ohio State, and obviously they did more than that last year, but McCarthy has got a chance to grow over the rest of the season. Blake Corum has some speed. Granted, they played, I think, two really
bad
cupcake. I mean, Hawaii is, I mean, they basically had a player revolt that led to Todd Graham being let go last year, and plays with Timmy Chang, who's a beloved son, but That's a long rebuilding job, and they're not going to go to the big house and win in a rainstorm and a lightning storm on the late Saturday night. So, but I think they have some talent clearly on offense, and that counts for something.
You're referring to Michigan and not Hawaii.
Yes.
Hawaii was outscored, by the way, 112-27 in their first two games against Vanderbilt and Western Kentucky. So that kind of tells you what Hawaii is right now.
Yeah, they're really bad. The Todd Graham hire a couple years ago was just totally baffling.
And then, you know, just to dance to, you know, Alabama, they beat our editor, Brian, pointed this out, you know, that they beat Utah State in the opener. People thought, okay, you know, Utah State's a pretty decent program. That's, you know, they've had some success. Well, Utah State lost to Weber State by 35-7 was the score. So you go, okay, just like you look at Ohio State's win over Notre Dame and say, okay, what was it really worth? You say the same thing about Alabama over Utah State, and obviously people think Notre Dame is better than Utah State. You know, Marcus Freeman's now 0-3, looking for his first win.
It's good Ohio State didn't have Marshall on the schedule this year.
That's true. Hey, the Marshall's a good program. It's, you know, they've had success. But, you know, and they didn't just beat Notre Dame. I watched the end of that game. They pretty much took it to them. At least the part of the game I watched, the end of the game, they took it to them. The same with Appalachian State against Texas A&M. I mean, that was no fluke. They ran the ball down their throat, and they were the better team.
think that pretty much sums up, I guess, a little bit of the state of college football. We touched on where the Buckeyes stand after beating Arkansas State on Saturday, and now they'll transition to Toledo to wrap up the non-conference schedule. It's another MAC school coming in. Ohio State doesn't usually have issues with the MAC. They're undefeated against the MAC since they started playing them about every year since 1992. So that doesn't really seem like a major threat. It's another non-conference tune-up game. But then things probably get a little more interesting, maybe with Wisconsin coming to town. But I think that's sort of where things stand.
Toledo is a pretty good MAC program.
Right, they're probably one of the more talented MAC teams. Like, if you were to size up the rosters of the MAC schools, right, they would probably have the highest number of blue chips, or not blue chips, but like recruiting
programs. Right. And they're only, I think, only in four, 31-point favorite. So it's not, they were 44 against Arkansas State, 31 against Toledo, which seems about right. I don't think this is going to be a 56-0 kind of game.
No, I don't think this is Akron last year. I mean, Akron was a team, a really sort of a cellar dweller in the MAC, and Toledo's a team that was picked second in the West, and has some talent. So there is a little bit of difference in terms of the MAC teams that they play. Miami, Ohio came a couple of years ago, and got spanked. It feels like Toledo's a little better. I did just look it up on the 247. The football team talent composite that they organized for this year, Toledo does have the highest ranked roster in the MAC. They have 2 4-stars.
One of them is Dallas Gann, right?
I would think so. I would think he would count toward that. And then 44 3-stars. So they have the highest, they have the most stars of anybody in the MAC.
Okay. So maybe it'll be more interesting than we think.
You never know. They gave Notre Dame a game last year in South Bend too.
Oh yeah, they should have beaten them.
Yeah,
yep.
So on the MAC scale, they're in the higher end. I didn't mean to totally gloss over things, right, but let's say what it is. It's another non-conference game. Buckeyes should win by multiple scores. Nonetheless, that covers it for this week's game as the Buckeyes beat Arkansas State 45-12. Make sure to visit dispatch.com for more coverage of the game, and as we segue into week 3 as Toledo comes to the Horseshoe. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will talk with you more this week.
Be sure and subscribe to the Buckeye Extra podcast in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on Stitcher.